Bob McCoy, and I'm presiding this morning. On my left is Justice Lee Gabriel. On my right is Justice Bill Meyer. We have three cases that we're calling for oral argument this morning, and we have some other cases that are being submitted without oral argument today. All right, let's begin by calling the first case.
The court will now call City Hall number 4-1-4-1. Will be in order to add Carson to everybody appellant and Mr. Shelton Martin to everybody appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. In this premises case, the appellant appeals from the trial court's granting of a motion for summary judgment on two grounds. Respectfully, the first ground is that the trial court abused its discretion in, on the one hand, enforcing a scheduling order that disallowed plaintiff's designation of a premises liability expert, and then on the other hand, not enforcing the scheduling order that permitted that allowed the defendant, the appellee in this case, to late file a motion for summary judgment, arguing as one of its grounds the lack of a premises liability expert. The second ground is that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment when the appellant presented sufficient evidence, creating a fact question on every element that was challenged by the appellee. On the first matter, it is undisputed that the appellant's motion for leave to late file a premises liability expert was declined or not granted. The trial court, in excluding the appellant's expert, enforced the terms of its scheduling order. It is also undisputed that on a day when myself, the plaintiff's attorney, had filed a vacation letter and was out of town on vacation, the appellee filed its motion for summary judgment as well as a motion to strike the late filed expert, had a hearing on the motion to strike, in fact, striking the late filed expert. I was able to come back in time to respond to the motion for summary judgment and to attend the hearing, but the court, again, undisputed that it failed to enforce the terms of its scheduling order in permitting the defendant to file late its motion for summary judgment and then granting the motion for summary judgment. Enforcing the schedule.
Did you complain to the trial court about the vacation letter issue?
I believe that was part of our motion for new trial. Quite frankly, that is the least of the matters here. At the conclusion of my presentation, I'll talk about the gamesmanship, but the real issue, the primary fundamental argument of the appellant in this case is the fact that the court, in enforcing the terms of the scheduling order on the one hand and not enforcing it on the other to the detriment of the plaintiff, failed to act with guiding principles and respectfully abused its discretion.
Did you address in your brief that the trial court declined to allow you to file a petition because the trial court was enforcing a scheduling order? I don't see that in your brief.
I believe we argued the fact that the scheduling order was enforced on the one hand and not on the other. I believe that's in our brief. The second ground of the appellant's appeal is the fact that even in spite of the fact that we did not have a premises liability expert, we were able to present sufficient evidence on every element challenged by the defendants. This is a premises liability case where Ms. Palmer, an invitee in the garage of Performing Arts, was there to see a show. She parked on the fifth floor, came down, went to the show. On her way back, unfamiliar with the area, she went in an entrance to the garage, was walking up an incline on a sidewalk next to where cars drive through, and came to a step down that was not visible. It was a darkened part of the garage. It was unmarked in every way. There was no signage whatsoever. When she stepped down, she misstepped, fell, and injured her shoulder. We brought forth evidence of the fact that this is from the corporate representative of Performing Arts, who says, yes, a step down in a darkened, unlit area can be a dangerous condition.
But they said it was a hypothetical step down, not this step. It was marked by poles.
The step down was not marked by poles. There were poles, but there's nothing about the poles. And in fact, the corporate representative agreed that she didn't have any knowledge as to why those poles were there and what they were meant to do. There's nothing about those poles, and there's no evidence to suggest that there's anything about those poles that directs someone's attention to the fact that there's about to be a step down. She was asked questions regarding whether an unlit area where there's a step down that's hard to see could be a dangerous condition, and she agreed that could be dangerous. And you may be correct, but I think our burden is not to prove our case by preponderance of the evidence, but in the context of a motion for summary judgment to come forward with some evidence that would cause reasonable minds to differ. And we believe this testimony does create a fact question in that regard. They challenged whether or not they were occupiers of the premises. This is a garage, that they were licenses. We presented evidence of the license agreement between it and its counterpart, showing that on the days where there's a production, they are in charge of occupying, responsible for this garage. They have people on site, they have roamers that roam around for the sole purpose of providing security, not only to the cars of those that are parked, but to the patrons themselves. And we presented evidence that they failed in that regard to provide the necessary security. They failed in every regard in which to correct or warn and warn of this condition, which is their duty to an invitee. We presented evidence that Ms. Palmer was there, in fact, as an invitee. She was there to see the show as part of, and had parked in the garage under the context of their license agreement. We presented evidence of every element necessary, creating a fact question to defeat their motion for summary judgment, and for that reason, we believe the trial court erred in granting the summary judgment. During the next break, I will look in our brief to see if I can respond to your question.
What was your evidence that you had to make the bill to your response?
I don't know that. No, we did not attach evidence of our damages with respect to in response to our motion, their motion for summary judgment. However, we did file our uncontroverted billing and medical record affidavits. And Rule 166A says that the trial court should base its decision not only on that which is in the response, but also those documents that are on file with the court.
166A doesn't say that the court is responsible for looking through the entire file to see if there's some evidence to support in response to a no evidence motion. That's not the trial court's responsibility. You have to be guided in there or attach it to the court way or reference.
I referenced 166A, and I don't have the quote in front of me and what the actual quote is for 166A, but I believe it says that the trial court shall base its decision on not only that which is attached to the response to the motion for summary judgment, but on those documents that are actually on file with the court at the time. In that regard, Your Honor, I would point out that while it was my mistake for not attaching an affidavit to the motion, to the response to the motion for summary judgment, I was under the gun given the late notice of the motion for summary judgment since I was on vacation. And I would just, in addition, I think there's reference in our brief to a document produced from the defendant in which they agree that Ms. Palmer fell, injured her shoulder, suffered an injury, and was taken to the hospital. Again, we're not required to prove our case by preponderance of the evidence, but just to come forward with some evidence to create a fact question. All right. Counselor?
May it please the court. Good morning. Performing Arts Fort Worth is the not-for-profit entity that owns and operates Bass Performance Hall. This is a premises liability action arising out of a fall that allegedly occurred in a parking garage across the street from Bass Performance Hall on Fifth Street. Now, I heard appellant's counsel in the argument mention several times that it was Performing Arts' parking garage, but that's factually incorrect. Parking garage is neither owned nor operated by Performing Arts. Performing Arts merely has a license to use for its patrons to use the parking garage during particular times on certain days during Bass Hall performances. I'll address each of the two arguments raised by appellant in turn. First, with respect to the timeliness issue. Appellant argues that the motion was improperly heard outside of the dispositive motion deadline. Yet the court has wide discretion in...
Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It was heard 6 weeks.
What are you thinking, filing it outside the court's order timeline?
There was a number of documents given to us late in the game, and as we progressed toward trial, we realized that there was no claim in this case.
Did you ask permission so that the court would have an order on file allowing you to do that?
We did not, Your Honor.
Okay.
But with that said, there's a number of cases that, under this very same fact pattern, that hold that by hearing the motion and overruling appellate's objection to the timeliness of the summary judgment motion, that the trial court implicitly modified the scheduling order.
Is that somewhere on the record? Was that discussion had at your hearing so that it's on the record where the trial court agreed with your position?
The trial court, an objection was made to the timeliness in appellant's response to the summary judgment, and in the record there's a order overruling that objection to the timeliness. And we cite Trevino versus Trevino and other cases which hold that although the court's reasoning is not apparent from the record, it appears that the court allowed the late filed motion to prevent an unnecessary trial, just as in this case.
Was the filing of his expert necessitated by the filing of your motion for summary judgment?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, you filed a motion for summary judgment. Did he have to file an expert to address your motion for summary judgment?
No, his expert designation was filed before we filed our motion for summary judgment. And by the way, the expert designation was never raised at the hearing on the summary judgment. It's nowhere in the record. It wasn't raised in appellant's brief. For the first time, I've heard that today, that it's sort of this, you didn't enforce it against me, but you did enforce it against them or the other way around. And so I don't think that's ripe for appeal as it's never been raised before today. Next, appellant argues that a vacation letter was on file. And there's no evidence in the record to support this scheme. There was a vacation letter that was filed with the court that blocked off nearly the month before trial. But the appellant received timely notice of the hearing prior to that vacation, never notified counsel for performing arts that he wasn't available. He filed a timely response. He attached evidence. He showed up to the hearing. He argued the motion. And he failed to even object on the basis of the vacation letter at the hearing. Moreover, the local rule which he applies is at the discretion of the court. And so the court had discretion to hear this summary judgment, and there was no harm to appellant when it did so. Next, appellant claims that the court improperly granted Performing Arts no evidence motion for summary judgment. However, if you look at the record, it's clear that there was no evidence presented on a number of claims. First, appellant presented no evidence that Performing Arts was a possessor of the premises. The owner of the garage is Crescent Real Estate, and Fort Worth's tax increment reinvestment zone number 3 had a lease with Crescent Real Estate to use the garage. In turn, Fort Worth Tax Investment Increment Reinvestment Zone gave a license to Performing Arts just to use the garage for a very limited purpose. And to establish the possessor element of a premises liability claim, they have to show that Performing Arts not only occupied the garage, but also had the intent to control the garage.
Well, who, if it wasn't Performing Arts, who was it?
Well, it would have been the owner of the garage that should have been the proper party to a premises.
Performing Arts is using?
Performing Arts is has a license to use the garage.
Okay. So the user is not the possessor?
The user is not the possessor under the elements, as the courts have described possessor in the context of a premises liability claim. It has to be not only the occupier, but also someone who's in control of the garage. And
but Crescent isn't occupying it when it's being used by somebody else.
But they would be in control of it.
You said occupier and, okay.
And perhaps I can clarify. In this case, the garage has, this is a 15-story garage that has numerous
I know where it is.
Numerous parking. So all the while there's a limited license for performing arts to use 700 spaces, there's a great deal more spaces in the garage that are still being continuously leased by Crescent and that the D.R. Horton, that people in the D.R. Horton Tower are using to park there. And so, for example, performing arts was only permitted to use the garage in accordance with the rules and regulations of the landlord, which was Crescent. And they were only allowed to use it for this very limited purpose. And they were required in the license to give deference to all other people using the garage. And there was no requirement at all to maintain, to improve, or to make any alteration to the garage. So they were simply had a right for their patrons to use it during particular times. They never collected money. It was just a license to use for their patrons to use the hall or to use it during Bass Hall performances. Next, appellant presented no evidence that there was an unreasonable risk of harm, none whatsoever. The only evidence cited in the response to the summary judgment is the deposition of Performing Arts corporate representative Dion Kennedy. And the only thing that's referenced there is an abstract step down. It's not the particular step down in question. There's no evidence as to whether the lighting, there was an issue with the lighting or there was an issue with this particular garage. There's no evidence that this particular garage was an unreasonable risk. And even if you look at the question and answer that's cited on pages 1 and 8 of appellant's brief and that was relied on in the response to the summary judgment, it reads, question, would you agree with me that a step down that is not very visible to someone who doesn't know that it's there can be a tripping hazard? Answer, I would say if someone is not paying attention, they could trip and fall. That's the question and answer. That's the sole evidence relied on as to this being an unreasonably dangerous condition. This curb is no different than any other curb in Fort Worth, except for the fact that it has three poles in front of it. And there's simply no evidence in the record whatsoever to substantiate the fact that this is an unreasonably dangerous condition, that a reasonable person would suspect that an injury would occur. There's no evidence, again, and I won't go into these elements, but there's no evidence that Performing Arts knew or should have known about the danger. There's no evidence that Performing Arts breached its duty to adequately warn. And finally, there's no evidence of damages. As was properly pointed out earlier, there were affidavits on file, but those affidavits were not specifically cited in the response to the summary judgment. And there's a number of cases, and we cite them in our brief, and I would point the court to Speck versus First Evangelical as an example, that says that even if the documents are attached to the response for summary judgment, even if they're attached evidence, if they're not specifically cited, then the court doesn't consider them. And so that follows that any affidavits on file with medical records cannot be considered unless they're specifically identified as evidence in the response. And here, the only evidence specifically identified in the response was page and lines from the deposition of Dion Kennedy.
Well, let's read what says the judgment shall be rendered forthwith if the definition transcript, interrogatory answers, and other discovery responses reference or set forth in the motion or response, that's what you're talking about, or two, the pleading conditions, affidavits, et cetera, on file at the time of the hearing or file thereafter for judgment. So the rule kind of reads like certain things need to be referenced, like deposition transcript, interrogatory answers, other discovery responses referenced in the motion, and then other things on file.
I don't have a case, Your Honor. I haven't been able to find a case that says that you can file, put anything on file, and you don't have to cite it, and it can't, and the court then has an obligation to go search the file.
I'm hearing what you're saying makes sense. I'm just reading the black and white rule that I didn't write.
I think if you look at the cases that we've cited, Speck and others, I think that what the purpose behind those cases say, or the reasoning behind the cases are that the trial court doesn't have the burden or shouldn't have the burden to go out and search for evidence that evidence specifically has to be identified, and it wasn't here.
But we don't have a case that says that. I hear your common sense, but you've got common sense versus the wording of the rule.
I think if you look at the cases, interpreting the summary judgment rule, I think that those would follow with what we're saying.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your client is a licensee. He came along at a point in time whenever this garage facility was already built. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So what did your client have to do with the design of the project to allow this curb to be put in the place where it was placed on the premises?
Our client had nothing to do.
And did your client maintain in any way the surface condition of the garage at the time that it had permission to have cars parked there during Bass Hall performance?
It didn't, and our client had no obligation under the license to make any alteration. In fact, no right to make any alteration to the garage.
And had your client ever been sued before or given any notice of any claim issue with this particular part of the parking garage?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And finally, with respect to the traditional motion for summary judgment, as the court is aware, the court need not even consider the traditional motion unless it finds that the court erred with respect to the no evidence motion. But we would ask the court, with respect to the traditional motion, to the extent it ever got there, that to look at this court's opinion in Hale versus Polar, where this court held, when a pleading deficiency is the type that cannot be cured by amendment, a special exception is unnecessary and a summary judgment based on the pleading's failure to state a legal claim is in order. Here, the appellant first alleged a negligence claim, but it should have, because it was a premises defect in question, it should have properly alleged a premises liability claim. But as we've discussed, because we weren't the possessor as a matter of law, because there's no evidence that this curb was unreasonably dangerous and it's not as a matter of law, they could not have amended to allege a premises liability claim. And therefore, traditional summary judgment was also proper in the case. For those reasons and those stated in our brief, we'd ask that the court affirm the trial court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Rebuttal, counsel?
Addressing your question, I could not find a specific reference in our brief with respect to the trial court's enforcing the scheduling order on the one hand as against the appellant, but not enforcing it as to the appellee. There is reference in our motion for new trial, which in fact there's, I think, page 8 of one of our exhibits is the order in which the trial court grants the motion to strike the plaintiff's expert. We respectfully submit that the substantive motion for summary judgment should never have been reached because the trial court, regardless if the court this appellate court considers the trial court's enforcing the scheduling order on the one hand to the detriment of the appellant, but declining to enforce the scheduling order to the detriment of the appellee. We believe that the facts of this case, that the trial court should never have reached the motion for summary judgment because it was filed untimely. If the trial court was permitted to go to the to ignore the scheduling order and have the motion for summary judgment considered, we contend that there is sufficient evidence of a dangerous condition of which Performing Arts had a responsibility. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not Performing Arts as the licensee has a duty. They are an occupier. As the licensee of this premises, they are an occupier, and they owe the same duties as to invitees, licensees, and trespassers that any other occupier of property owes. And because Ms. Palmer was an invitee, Performing Arts did owe her the duty to correct and warn of any dangerous conditions of which they knew or should have known. The case law, and I can't quote a particular site at this moment, but the case law that I'm familiar with talks about occupiers and possessors having as being the ones in control of the premises. In this particular instance, we have Performing Arts that have people positioned that are directing patrons into the parking garage. They have roamers there to assist patrons in and out of the parking garage to provide security, and yet the evidence is that they provided no training to this personnel. They had no formal regulation as it relates to inspection, and quite frankly, this condition is one that
for as often as Performing Arts is on this property and control this property, this condition is one that should have been discovered by Performing Arts. And to the extent that they're occupying the property, they do have a duty as to invitees to correct and warn of this condition. And to address the comments made by Justice Meyer, even though Performing Arts did not design the property, did not maintain the property, did not, there's no evidence of any prior incidents, because they are a possessor and occupier, and respectfully, I don't have a site, but the authority that I'm familiar with says that possessors and occupiers have those duties as it relates to invitees.
Mr. Hardison.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the license agreement, did it specify, I didn't see it, did a portion of the garage that was specifically to be used by Performing Arts Fort Worth Inc. and along with the other, as I understand, about half of the garage was 700 parking places, and so it wasn't. Was there a place in the lease, in the licensing agreement, which specified this part of the, in other words, you park on the first floor, lower, whatever. Didn't know if there was anything that specifically set out a place within the whole premises that would be more likely to fit your argument of control by occupants.
Your Honor, it's been a while since I've studied the licensing agreement, and it is rather lengthy. I cannot answer your question one way or the
That's
other.
Okay, we'll look at it.
All right. In summary, the motion for summary judgment should never have been reached. The trial court abused its discretion on the one hand in ignoring the scheduling order and allowing defendant to file and have heard and grant the motion for summary judgment, but on the other hand, denying plaintiff's motion for leave to designate a late expert that would have gone to defeat their motion for summary judgment. Secondly, the court erred because we did come forward with sufficient evidence on every element challenged by the defendant. We would ask this appellate court to reverse the trial court's granting of the motion for summary judgment and remand this case back for a trial.
All right. Thank you for your briefing and your oral argument, and your case is submitted.
Thank you.